I discovered the sub while with my friend Julia. We just got back from a camping trip where we experienced the scariest thing either of us have ever experienced. So Julia and I are both women in our early 20s, and we were out camping in a remote area of Montana that isn't super popular, but it's still fairly popular amongst locals who camp a lot like we do. Which meant that it wasn't super unusual when we saw a group of three guys who looked to be a little bit older than us drive past our camp about an hour after we had set up our chairs and table. We just assumed that they were searching for a good spot to camp. But then, when the car was still in our sight through the trees, we saw it turn around, and as it was driving back, we both noticed one of the guys sticking his phone out the window and seemed to be recording us. Both of us thought it was really weird, and I walked a bit closer to take a picture of their license plate as a safety measure, but when I got closer, I saw that the back plate had all the numbers covered with black paint. Julia and I both got bad vibes from this, but both of us were aware that men are creeps towards women all the time, and both of us are prepared with bear spray, because Montana is grizzly bear country, and we decided it wasn't a weird enough interaction to pack our stuff and find a different spot. We decided to set up an empty tent outside and sleep in my car instead to trick people into thinking that we were sleeping in the tent in case anyone tried to attack us. Now later that night, while we were both asleep in my car, we heard branches rustling and snapping near the empty tent, despite the calm weather. Initially, we assumed it was a bear trying to reach the bear bag with our food and scented hygiene products, and then we heard male voices outside. I lifted my head to the window and saw the same car that had passed us earlier. I got off the air mattress on top of the back row of seats that we had put down to create a sleeping area and locked the doors individually to avoid the car making a beeping noise. Julia and I stayed still, hoping the men would leave. We would hear them talking, but it was difficult to make out their words from inside the car. The rustling and snapping of branches continued, leading us to think that they were trying to steal something from the bear bag. However, neither of us wanted to look out the window in case one of them spotted us. Eventually, we heard the car leave, which was a huge relief. However, we were too frightened to leave the car until daylight when other campers would be waking up. When I finally got out, nothing could have prepared me for what I saw. Above our tent, the men had hung a dead deer that had obviously been killed recently, as it was leaking blood all over our tent. The internal organs were ripped out and its limbs were cut off and laid out in a circle around the tent. This was disturbing enough on its own, but hunting permits weren't even being sold at the time, which meant that the deer had been killed illegally. And once we processed what we were seeing, Julia and I freaked out and drove away without taking down our camp. Once we had cell service, Julia called the police and the Forest Service to report what had happened while I drove home. The Forest Service was kind enough to retrieve our belongings, but I don't even want mine back in case there was some weird curse put on them with those weirdos. The police are investigating to impose a fine for killing wild game out of season, but as far as I know, what they did to us isn't technically illegal, just very strange and really creepy. I haven't heard of anything like this before, but if you have, let me know. I'm very curious and also very spooked. I love camping, but after this, I don't know if I can camp for a long time.
Hey guys, thanks so much for all the support. If you haven't subscribed to the channel yet, please feel free to do so.
For more than 100 years now, both Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts have sat around roaring log fires at night and carried on the rich tradition of telling campfire tales. For the most part, these stories have detailed the murderous exploits of all kinds of boogeymen, monsters, and cryptids. Yet some touch on another oft-told urban legend, that of the deranged psycho killer, the escaped asylum patient, hell-bent on the meaningless slaughter of innocents. However, as terrifying as these stories may be, we still use them for entertainment purely on the premise that they're completely fictional, that the monsters we're so afraid of can't really hurt us. There aren't any real psychopathic killers out there in the woods, are there? But maybe it'd be best to hear the story of the Oklahoma Girl Scout murders before we make any definitive judgment on that. Nestled into Mays County, Oklahoma, Camp Scott used to be one of the Sooner State's premier Girl Scout camps. It's also one of the oldest, with the year 1977 being the 50th anniversary of its founding. Camp Scott also happens to be located on 410 acres of the most beautiful land in the entire country, with the surrounding area comprised of gently sloping hills, Tolkien-esque forests, and a tranquil freshwater creek. Interspersed in the area are a series of platform tent clusters which host any visitors. For those who were never scouts as kids, a platform tent is a large canvas tent pitched semi-permanently on a raised wooden platform, sometimes with a tin roof or tarp on top. It can usually sleep 4 to 6 people and has zippers on both sides of the tent to close the inner flap, with ties to close the outer and side flaps. There is no way to 100% close the tent in a secure way, but it is generally sturdier of an option than tent camping on the ground, and platform tents are somewhere between a cabin and a tent in terms of comfort. Like many Girl Scout camps, the tents at Camp Scott were arranged in small campsites scattered throughout the camp, each with fire pits and related amenities, with each named after a Native American tribe. You could be forgiven for thinking the camp was an outdoor paradise, a serene, wholesome slice of Eden, brimming with innocence, far from the hustle and bustle of the big city. But just a short while before the camp season of 1977, a training session was held in which veteran camp counselors would coach the incoming counselors in training on what would be expected of them. One of these counselors picked up a box of donuts on the way over, finding that a sweet treat made for a great conversation starter among the new arrivals and generally made them feel more welcomed. She shared a few of the donuts among her fellow counselors, but left the remaining donuts back near the counselor campground when she took the new arrivals on a tour of the area. When she returned, the donuts were gone, and in their place was a filthy handwritten note that bore just 3 scrawled words. 3 will die. The girl immediately showed the note to one of the camp's head of operations, but instead of taking the threat seriously, they dismissed the note as nothing but a tasteless prank and instructed the counselors to go about their business as usual. On the first day of camp season, Girl Scouts from all 4 corners of Oklahoma were bussed into Camp Scott to begin the first of many week-long visits. The mood was generally high among the young women, as school had recently finished and that summer break elation was still very much at its peak. But that Sunday, June 12th, was hardly an ideal summer's day. Thick fogs and misty rains had turned the camp into a complete soaked mess. Yet the Girl Scouts' spirits weren't dampened, and they remained positive as they were split into groups and shown to their respective campgrounds. Thankfully, the weather relented enough for the girls to partake in a few camp activities before sundown. But as night fell, the rain resumed with a vengeance, and what had previously been a light smattering of drizzle turned into a full-on downpour. To keep from being soaked, the Girl Scouts rushed back to their platform tents to bed down early, confident that the weather would improve so they could return to their wholesome outdoor fun. The following morning, one of the counselors collected her wash kit and headed over to the camp's shower block. This shower block just so happened to be right at the rear of the camp near a collection of platform tents known as Kiowa. And thanks to the horseshoe arrangement of the platforms, one of them was ever so slightly obscured from view by the shower block itself. So at around 6 a.m. on the 13th of June, this counselor headed down the hillside to the trail which led to the bathhouse. But as she approached, she spotted 3 apparently occupied bags just lying there on the trail, sleeping bags that had been piled up against each other in a disturbingly unnatural way. There was no way there would be Girl Scouts in there. There was no way anyone could sleep like that. No one living, anyway. Because when the young counselor unzipped the sleeping bags to peek at what was inside, the entire camp was awoken by a blood-curdling scream. Inside the sleeping bags were 8-year-old Lori Lee Farmer, 9-year-old Michelle Heather Goose, and 10-year-old Doris Denise Miller. Each had their skulls bashed in by a large blunt object, with at least two of them showing signs of heavy strangulation. The camp was immediately evacuated while one of the camp's directors contacted the local police force. Sniffer dogs were brought in to search for clues, and a single unknown fingerprint was taken from one of the girls' flashlights, and a bloody size 9.5 footprint was found in the tent the girls were missing from. Shortly after the camp was closed off as a crime scene, police interviewed a nearby homeowner who reportedly heard something rather heavy on the small road running between the camp and his property at around 3 a.m. on the morning of the 13th. Since all the counselors had solid alibis for the determined times of death, it was deduced that this must have been the killer moving to and from the area. After a large-scale manhunt was launched to flush out the murderer, local and federal law enforcement honed in on a man named Gene Leroy Hart. Hart already had multiple convictions for indecent assault, attempted murder, burglary, and escaping federal custody. And although he lived out near Tulsa at the time of the murders, it turned out that he grew up in a house less than a mile away from Camp Scott. It also turned out that Gene Leroy Hart was of Native American heritage, Cherokee to be exact, so police began to canvass the local charity community in hopes that they could assist them in tracking Hart down. Despite being somewhat distrustful of the visiting police officers, it said that once the local Cherokee learned that Hart was wanted in connection with the murder of three little girls, they fell over themselves to aid in the investigation. Eventually, a Cherokee man contacted the police by telephone, informing them of a rumor that Hart was sheltering in the isolated traditional home of a well-known medicine man. And although the place proved difficult to find, police found the tip to be a good one. Hart was arrested there and then, with the medicine man insisting he had no idea Hart was accused of such a heinous crime. According to him, Hart had merely confessed to doing something terrible, although he wouldn't specify exactly what it was. At his trial for the girls' murders, the local sheriff claimed that he was 1,000% sure that Hart was the guilty party. Yet despite the man's blind certainty, there was a number of holes in the prosecution's argument that were too significant to discount. The most pertinent being that Hart didn't wear a 9.5 size shoe, meaning it couldn't have been him that stepped in the girl's blood back at Camp Scott. The prosecution argued that a man could easily wear a size too small or too large, and that the defense's argument was a flimsy one. However, when all the evidence was taken into consideration, the jury simply couldn't find Hart guilty beyond all reasonable doubt. Hart had a violent past, that much is clear, but to scapegoat him purely to sate rabid public demands for justice would be hideously unfair. Of course, there was a chance he was guilty. There was plenty of circumstantial evidence, but a man should only be locked in a cage for the rest of his life if the jury are, as the sheriff so clumsily put it, 1,000% certain. To their credit, the jury found Hart not guilty of the murders, and he walked away a free man. Yet this freedom was short-lived. After later violating his parole conditions, Hart was sent back to prison to finish his original 308-year prison sentence. You heard that right. The crimes that Hart had previously been convicted of were so utterly atrocious and prolific that a judge had seen fit to sentence him to more than 300 years in a federal penitentiary. He died of a heart attack in the prison exercise yard just 2 years later. But on the advent of DNA testing, police had the means to close the book on the Oklahoma Girl Scout murderers once and for all. When test results came back, police were stunned to discover that the chances of Hart being the girl's killer was almost 1 in 8,000. The victims' families have since demanded that more modern equipment be used in the hopes of getting more accurate readings, but law enforcement have insisted that the chances of an alternate result coming back are slim to none. As for the site of the murders, Camp Scott was never reopened to the public, becoming far too associated with a horrifying unsolved tragedy in which three young girls needlessly lost their lives. And without anyone convicted, there was no way anyone was going to send their kids to Camp Scott while the killer still stalked the area. These days, there's little left but forest where the camp once stood. Nothing to remind anyone of the three little girls who only ever wanted to have a fun summer at camp, but never returned home. For the hunting season of 2017, I got in on a lease with a guy from work. I didn't have time to check the area out before the season started, so the inevitable occurred and I got lost my first day. That morning I left the camp just before dawn. I'm not the kind that hunts from a stand, I'm your traditional stalk and shoot type of hunter. Since I wasn't familiar with a lease and I stupidly left my GPS back at the camp, I had to stick to the main paths in order to not get lost. Most of the morning I did well. However, as I grew tired, I lost focus and veered from the trail. In my defense, I came across this really fresh set of tracks. Of course, I had to follow them. The sucky thing was that they continued on to a neighboring property and I had to stop following them. When I looked up, I realized I was way off the trail and didn't know how to get back. The rest of the day was spent trying to find my way back to camp. About an hour before dark, I noticed a run-down house and cabin in the distance. By now, I wasn't sure whose property I was on. I hoped that if somebody was living there, they could help me, but as I got closer, I could tell the place had been abandoned for a good while. I knocked to make sure, but with no reply, I made myself at home. My first goal was to get a fire going. After I did that, I began combing through the cabinets for food and other things I thought could help me. Not much but a questionable can of chili and some candles were found. I heated up the chili over the fire and combined it with a half-eaten bag of chips. After dinner, I looked through the bedroom and discovered an old map of the area. I wasn't sure how accurate it would be after all that time, but I was happy to find it. I spread it out on the floor in front of the fireplace and planned my course for the morning. I was shocked to see that I had veered over 5 miles from where I'd started. At some point, I must have dozed off. During the night, I had a super vivid dream that a man was sitting in the chair next to me and just staring. He never said a word. And when I jerked awake and saw that I was alone, I was relieved and quickly fell back asleep. The following morning, I woke up at 6:15 and got my stuff together. I made sure the fire was completely put out and headed back to camp. I just stepped from the house when I came face to face with a strange man. The guy from my dream, in fact. I was confused at first, and when he spoke, I knew my dream had really happened. This man was holding an old Marlin 30-30, not an odd sight for a hunter during deer season. This dude didn't look like a hunter, though. He wore an old, dirty backpack and normal, bright, yet dingy street clothes. His eyes had a very crazed look to them that made me uncomfortable to gaze at. I was surprised, but regained my calm and said, "Good morning." Instead of saying it back, he just stared at me with those crazed black eyes. I began to say something, but he interrupted and asked what I was doing in the cabin. Before I could answer, he blurted out that it was his place. I continued and explained what had happened the day before. The entire time I was telling him this, he was gripping the rifle so tightly his knuckles were beginning to turn white. His behavior was beginning to scare me. The only thing I wanted to do was get back to camp and then home. The last word had barely left my lips before he angrily told me that it was his place. It appeared to have been empty for quite a while, but I wasn't going to argue with him. I apologized as quickly as I could and went on my way. For a good 100 yards or more, I kept looking behind me. I was waiting to get shot in the back. Every time I looked back, he was staring maniacally back at me and death gripping his gun. It took a couple of hours to find my way back, but by then, I'd had plenty of time to dwell upon our encounter, and I was truly freaked out by then. It actually hit me. The guys that were still in camp were happy to see me and asked what had happened. I just said I got lost and camped out for the night, never mentioning the nutcase that I met. I doubt that they take it seriously anyhow. The whole experience had me so scared I wanted nothing more than get home. The other guys must have thought I was crazy. After throwing all my stuff into the back of my truck, I tore off out of there and never returned. I knew I'd never be able to feel safe knowing that kook was somewhere out in the woods, possibly watching our party. That following Monday, my friend asked what had caused me to leave so abruptly. I made up some lie about my wife being sick. I'm not sure if he even believed it. Nothing was said about it again, and maybe, just maybe, things are better that way.